Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 84. This one is entitled The Fallibility of Infallible Ecumenical Councils, which might be the wordiest title I've ever selected, but we're going to be looking at the book of Hebrews. We're doing a four-part series in the book of Hebrews, and today we'll be looking at chapter 1. Now, before we get to the ideas of Hebrews chapter 1, we need to talk a little bit about church history. Now, church history began with the death of Christ sometime around the year 30 CE, and it has run all the way until today in 2017 CE. But the section of church history that I really want to focus on is from that time of the death of Christ to a very specific date. The date I'm speaking of is 681 CE. And you may ask, what is significant about 681 and why are we talking about it? Well, that is the year that the Third Ecumenical Council of Constantinople happened. Because the ideas that are in Hebrews 1 influence Christianity from 30 CE to 681 CE when a group of church leaders got together in Constantinople for the third time. So let's look at church history for the first 650 years. It all began, as we said earlier, with the death of Christ around the year 30 CE. Now, Christians proclaim that Jesus was raised from the dead within 3 days of his death and that multiple people saw him walking around. Jesus then ascends back to heaven, and Christianity begins as they tell the world the good news of Jesus Christ. Christians are sent out across the Western world with the message of Jesus. And one of these Christians is writing a sermon, and this sermon becomes a writing. This sermon would later become known as Hebrews, and it was written between the year 50 to 90 CE. Now, a few things about the author. We don't know who the author was. However, we have a strong sense that the author was in fact a man. We know this because in Hebrews chapter 11, at one point the author refers to himself by using the singular masculine pronoun in the Greek language, indicating that he is in fact a man. So this author, who definitely isn't Paul, for a number of reasons, writes this sermon because he wants to tell the world who Jesus is. And so we find his description in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. The author of Hebrews writes these words: "Long ago, God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by a son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. When he has made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than others." And so this sermon is written down between 50 to 90 CE. The author of Hebrews believes that Jesus Christ is more than just a mere man. But if you look closely at the words in Hebrews chapter 1, the author also believes that Jesus existed before the life of Jesus, that he was there when the foundation of the earth was being laid. And this being that was superior to the angels made himself inferior to the angels, died, was resurrected, and then restored himself to superiority over the angels. Now, if this sounds complicated and confusing, understand that we are standing a long way away from the events that Hebrews describes in church history, because church history did its best to try and reconcile who this Jesus person was, because Jesus presented a major theological problem for Christians. This problem was simply this: they proclaim that Jesus was in fact God. But when they tell the world that Jesus was God, what the world would hear was they would hear that Jesus was a God and that God the Father was a God. So they would say, oh, then you are polytheists. And because Christianity is rooted in Judaism, these Christian Jews would look at them and say, oh, no, we're not polytheists. We're definitely monotheists. And the people that were hearing this message would scratch their head and say, well, you sure sound like polytheist to me, because there's definitely more than one God in your religion. And so the church argued back and forth and back and forth over the next 100 years as they tried to decide who Jesus was and how Jesus fit within the doctrine of monotheism. Eventually, some ideas began to develop, and this idea that developed was the idea of Trinity. And Trinity was first argued in Latin by a man named Tertullian. Tertullian lived between the years 155 and 240 CE. And because he had such a desire to tell the world who Jesus was, he developed this doctrine of the Trinity from theologians who had come before him. It's important that Christians understand where this idea of the Trinity came from, because a lot of people think that it comes from the Bible. Well, there's a couple problems with that. The first is the word Trinity shows up nowhere within Scripture. It is not a biblical word. It did not show up in written defense until 200 years after the life of Christ. Now, there are allusions to the Trinity throughout Scripture, but the word Trinity itself does not show up. Second, it's important for us to understand that the doctrine of the Trinity came from a crisis of trying to avoid polytheism. And this was a necessary doctrine because it helped to establish that Jesus was, in fact, God. So Tertullian was the first person to write in defense of the doctrine of the Trinity in Latin, and that was a major deal. As we keep going through church history, church changes quite a bit in 306 CE. Because in 306, a man named Constantine became emperor of Rome. Now, he rose to the throne of Rome on the back of a Christian message. And because of this Christian message, he proclaimed that Christianity was now the official state religion of the Roman Empire. And as you can imagine, taking a Christian message which was born in poverty in first century Palestine and placing it on the throne of the Empire of Rome would fundamentally change the way that Christianity was perceived. You can understand this, right? And so from 306 on, Christianity is very different than what it was before. And as Christianity is developing and growing, there are people that are starting to chime in that are now hundreds of years after the life of Christ that are trying their best to understand who Jesus is in relation to who God is. One of these men who was trying to understand who Jesus was a man named Arius. And Arius believed that Jesus was holy, but wasn't quite as holy as God the Father. In other words, Arius believed that Jesus was the first of all created beings, but because Jesus had to be created, he was somewhat inferior to who God the Father was. So Arius and his followers, known as the Arians, developed a phrase. This phrase was this: there was when he was not. And a lot of people caught on to this idea because it helped them understand how God could become human. However, at the same time, there was a lot of pushback to the Arian doctrine. And Constantine felt this all the way in Rome. And because he felt this pressure, he got a group together and he said, "We need to decide who Jesus is." He called this group together in a place called Nicaea, which is in modern-day Turkey. And they had the first ecumenical council in 325 CE. It was there that they adopted a word, a Greek word, called homoousios. And they said Jesus is homoousios with the Father, which means that Jesus is the same substance as the Father. He is of equal materiality and divinity and godlikeness as the Father in heaven. And so they decided that the word homoousios was the only appropriate word to describe Jesus, of the same substance. At that same council, they also declared that Arius was a heretic, which is something that councils love to do. So this council met in 325, and they made this decision with prayer and open hearts and open yearning, and they said, whatever our decision is, it's infallible because God is with us. And so they made the decision that Jesus was, in fact, homoousios with the Father. And once they made that decision, you can imagine there was peace and prosperity and brotherhood and just a sense of heaven on earth from that moment forward. Except you and I know that's not how it works. Because shortly after they established the word homoousios was the only way to describe Jesus, there was another controversy that arose in the church. And a second group of people said, "We like the word homoousios, but there's a better word to describe Jesus. The word is homoiousios, which means of a similar substance rather than the same substance." This allowed people to hold on to their Arianism, the idea that Jesus was inferior to God but superior to the angels, and at the same time accept the Council of Nicaea as a true council of God. Well, this created some controversy. And so once again, the Roman Empire, without Constantine, because he's dead now, said we need to have another ecumenical council. So in 381, there is a group of people that got together in Constantinople, and they heard the critique that Jesus is homoiousius with the Father, and they responded with a one-word phrase, no. No, Jesus is not of a similar substance. Jesus is homoousius. That's the only right word for Jesus, which means that Jesus is the same substance of the Father. At that council, they also condemned another man, a man named Demophilus, because that's what they do. They said Demophilus is a heretic. And after 381, once they decided that, you can imagine there was peace and prosperity for all time. Except there wasn't. Because in 397, 16 years later, they decided that they needed to establish a Bible. We talked about this a couple weeks ago. In the Council of Carthage, they established 80 books as scripture. One of those books was the Book of Hebrews. And after they established the books of scripture, there was another man who came along, a man named Nestorius. And Nestorius began teaching a new kind of understanding of God. His teaching was that there were, in fact, two distinct hypostases within Christ. Now, if that sounds big and overwhelming to you, I will tell you this. It sounds big and overwhelming to me. Basically, two distinct hypostases within Christ means that Jesus had two different existences that did not mesh together at all. It's like Jesus had two brains. One was human, one was divine, and they never interacted with one another. This allowed Nestorians to believe that Jesus could be fully divine and at the same time be different than Jesus, while at the same time being close to the same. This caused a big controversy within the church, and so they held another council in 431 in Ephesus, which is still in Turkey, and they heard Nestorius' teaching, and they said, no, there is only one distinct hypostasis within Christ. They then said that Nestorius is a heretic, because once again, that's what councils do, and because they had prayed and thought about God, you can imagine there was peace and prosperity for all time. Except all time only lasted a few years, because after Nestorius, a guy named Eutyches came along, and Eutyches said, I think we should all believe in monophysitism. Now, if monophysitism sounds big and overwhelming to you, I will tell you that monophysitism is big and overwhelming to me as well. Because monophysitism is the idea that God is fully human and fully divine, but they blend together. And because they blend together, Jesus had an experience and an existence that is unlike anything God existed in and unlike anything that any human being has existed in. This caused a big controversy within the early church, and so they decided to hold another council, and this place is called Chalcedon, which is in modern-day Turkey. This Council of Chalcedon happened in 451 CE. They heard the critiques of monophysitism, and they responded by this, no. We don't believe in monophysitism. It's in fact heresy, and Eutyches is also a heretic. And because they got together and planned, once again, another council where they prayed and were open to God, you can imagine there was nothing but peace and prosperity for all time after that. If all time is just a few years. Because shortly after 451 CE, the emperor of the Byzantines, a man named Justinian, came before the church longing to reconcile the empire that was fracturing within itself. He went to the church and he said, we should reconcile with the Nestorians and the Monophysites. And because the emperor came before the church, he was basically begging them to unite one another with the Eastern and Western kingdom for the good of Rome. The church heard his concerns, and once again, they held a council. This was the Council of Constantinople II, and it was held in 553 CE, and Justinian, the emperor, was asking them to compromise on some of their doctrines of who Jesus was to unite the Roman Empire. The council heard his concerns and responded with this, no. And it was at this council that they decided that Nestorius was still a heretic. And Justinian walked away defeated, and the church walked away powerful, while Rome was still fractured. Which brings us to the next emperor, shortly after Justinian. This was a man named Heraclius, and he went before the church and he said, we should reconcile with the Nestorians and the Monophysites. He's taking a page directly out of Justinian's playbook. So Emperor Heraclius goes before the church and he says, we have this new doctrine. It's called Monothelitism. And Monothelitism is big and overwhelming to you and to me, and basically it's this idea. Jesus was fully human and fully divine, but he only had a divine will, not a human will. So therefore, he wasn't tempted by the same things that you and I are tempted as human beings. Because of this idea of monothelitism, the church held another council in 681. This was the Council of Constantinople III, and it was here that they heard the doctrine of monothelitism, and they responded by saying this: no, no, and no. Jesus is fully human and fully divine, they said. Jesus has a fully human will and a fully divine will. And then they also wanted to condemn somebody because that's what you do with these councils. And it was here that they said, and by the way, Nestorius is still a heretic. Thank you for making it this far on the podcast. Over the past 15 minutes, we just did 650 years of church history. And I share all of this with you as you're listening to this podcast because it's important for all of us to understand something. For 650 years, the predominant question in the church was the divinity of Christ. As you can imagine, it was really difficult for a group of people to believe that God had walked among them in a human life. And so there is council after council after council trying to specify about monothelitism and monophysitism and whether or not Jesus was a blend or separate or fully human, fully divine, or whether Jesus was the first of all created beings. It went on and on and on. And if you're not a Christian and you're hearing all this and you feel like this is way too much drama for you, I want you to know something. I know how you feel, because I would walk away from this too. Because anytime you hear about all these councils and these different theological ideas, it's important to ask a question. And this is the most important question in all of theology. The question is simply this: so what? So what? So what if Jesus was fully human or fully divine? So what if monophysitism is true? So what if the Arians were actually correct or whether they were heretics? What does it actually matter? And how does it change my life? And I've got to tell you that when you look through church history, it's really hard to come up with an answer to the question, so what? When you look at all of these councils and how minute and small and narrow-minded they are about things that no human being knows. Sure, they can pray for guidance. Sure, they can believe that their councils are infallible. But let's be honest, nobody really knows how it is this incarnation actually happened. Nobody actually knows how much of Jesus was fully God or how much of Jesus was fully human. That's things that we cannot know. And when you look at all of this church history, what's incredible is you look all the way back to 50 and 90 CE, when this sermon was written by somebody who we don't even know. And what he writes about the life of Jesus, and he basically from the very beginning, without using words like Trinity or monophysitism or all of those church councils, he says, you want to know who Jesus was? He was the Son of God. And the Son of God was there at the beginning. And then the Son walked among us. And the Son still lives. In other words, there were 650 years of debate as to who this Jesus was, and what the author of Hebrews said at the beginning was where the church ended up 600 years later. In Hebrews 1, he writes, long ago, God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by a son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the worlds. Jesus is the reflection of God's glory and the exact imprint of God's very being, and he sustains all things by his powerful word. When Jesus had made purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. And as you read those proclamations about who Jesus is, it's important for us to ask the most important theological question there is. So what? So what if that's true? You don't actually know that to be true, author of Hebrews, do you? So why does it matter if it is true? And when you read through the book of Hebrews, you realize why this author believes that this matters. In Hebrews 2, verse 10, he writes, "It was fitting that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, in bringing many children to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings." Now understand what the author of Hebrews is saying here. He is saying that this perfect God that created all lowered himself in order to practice solidarity with us through our suffering. That's a big deal if it's true. He then goes on to say, because Jesus himself was tested by what he suffered, he is able to help those who are being tested. What the author of Hebrews is saying is, have you ever been tested by this life? Has it ever threatened to break your spirit? Because the author says Jesus has too. And if Jesus has too, then that means God has too. And he is able to help us and be with us in the midst of our sufferings because of what this life of Jesus has been. In Hebrews chapter 3, the author writes, "For we have become partners of Christ, if only we hold our first confidence firm to the end." The author shows that in this life, here and now, we can become and have become partners of Christ as human beings. In Hebrews chapter 4, he writes, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin." This God is with us in the midst of our sufferings. In Hebrews chapter 5, the author writes, "In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverent submission." Jesus, God, cries loud cries with tears. And when we ask the author of Hebrews, so what? So what if Jesus is actually the Son of God? The response of the author of Hebrews says, oh, it changes everything. Because I believe that the author would say to us, the gospel is the counterintuitive story of God choosing to become human. And if this is true, then it changes everything, the author would say. To give you an idea, if this is true, and you have to look really closely at what the author is saying, he would say, if this is true, then to be human is to be good. Being human is not reprehensible to God. It does not anger God that you are human. The fact that you breathe, the fact that your heart beats, the fact that you sing and dance and make love and laugh and drink and eat and sleep, all of those are good because the God who is good has been through all of those as well. To be human, to be vulnerable, to weep, to suffer, all of it together is good. That's what the incarnation means to the author of Hebrews. I was recently reading an article in the New York Times about what it means to be human and how good it is. This article was written on September 5, 2017, and it was called "Women Are Making the Best Rock Music Today." And the interview went like this. They brought a bunch of lead singers who were women together, and they asked them a question. It was a roundtable interview. And the interviewer asked these lead singers the question, "How did you first start making music?" And Christina Halliday answered first. She's in a band called Sheer Mag, and she said, "Well, you have to suck for a while." Another woman, the lead singer of Diet Sig, Alex Luciano, said, "Yeah, you have to suck for so long. No one tells you that it's okay to suck." And then a woman who lead sings a band named Vagabond, Leticia Tomko, said, "But also, I feel like the fact that deciding to suck or figure it out openly is like the most powerful thing. Like, that's the brave thing, she says. What? When asked, how did you start making music? They respond, well, you just have to decide to suck. What a strange response that is. Because when you think about what it is that makes you inspired to write music, you would think like, well, I was just so inspired by the love or the beauty or all these things. And they say, oh, no, just decide it's okay to suck and you'll start writing music. And the more you think about it, the more brilliant their responses are. Because what they're saying is, get this, you don't start knowing how to write songs. You have to be okay with writing bad songs in order to write good songs. If you sit down and you write 10 songs, they would say, you'd be lucky if one of them was good. And if you surrender that outcome, if you surrender that idea, if you say, it's okay for me to write bad songs, then you'll write more and more and more songs. And by the time you've written 100 songs, 10 of them might be good and you've got an album, right? Now, this is counterintuitive to us because we like the easy route through things, don't we? In fact, if you watch the movie The Matrix, the premise of the movie is that you can jack into a central computer and learn things at a rapid rate. So at one point, Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, can learn Kung Fu by downloading it into his brain, and he has the mastery of Kung Fu within 3 minutes. This is remarkable, and it's amazing, and it's fun to think about, and it says, oh man, it'd be so nice to not have to suck. But here's the problem. Whatever that downloading of information into our brain is, just simply is not a human practice. That's not how we learn things as human beings, right? Instead, we hear a woman say, I feel like the fact that deciding to suck or figure it out openly is like the most powerful thing. Like, that's the brave thing, she says. What she's telling us is that humanity demands bravery. If you want to be a human being, it demands bravery, and it demands you taking the brave steps in order to choose humanity over the easy way out. And I want us to look at what it means to be human in four different ways that human beings are different than machines. And the four different ways we're going to look at are how we sleep, how we eat, how we drink, and how we have sex. So let's start with sleeping, shall we? We all love to sleep. I love to sleep. But here's the thing about sleeping. We're also afraid of it, aren't we? We're also afraid of it and we're annoyed by it because it gets in the way. We're frustrated with ourselves that we're not able to keep on going when our body tells us that we are tired. And so capitalist America has figured out that we want to conquer sleep. So they try to sell us all kinds of products that help us conquer sleep. For instance, I don't know if you've ever tried the incarnation of evil that is 5-Hour of Energy. That is like some of the most disgusting stuff I've ever tasted. But at the same time, the idea is, are you sleepy? If you drink this, you'll be good to go for 5 hours. But here's the truth. This isn't human. Downing all sorts of stimulants and extra things in order to conquer sleep just isn't human. You want to know what the most human thing is? Just simply sleeping. There's one time not too long ago, I was, before I was a pastor, I wanted to study the Bible more. So I went to a pastor of mine and I said to this pastor, I said, I want to study the Bible more, but I found that the more I read it, the more sleepy I get. And so I feel really guilty, pastor, because when I open the Bible to read it, I'm all motivated and I want to do this. And then within a few chapters, I start falling asleep as I read the Bible. And the pastor looked at me and said, well, why don't you just sleep more? That's good. It's a good question, right? And what the pastor was doing there that was so brilliant and was so helpful to me at that age and still helps me today was he was telling me it's more important to be human than it is to be religious. Yeah. Yeah, it's more important to be human than it is to be religious. Which brings us to what we eat. When I was in college, I was convinced that if I ate more Subway, I'd be healthier than if I ate more Taco Bell. I know, this is just the way college students think. But I don't know if Subway's marketing campaign had gotten to me where they said eat fresh, but I was just convinced that that was the healthy way to go when it came to fast food. Which is why it was so frustrating when in 2014, people figured out that Subway was using a chemical in their bread called azotocarbonamide. I can't say it really, I'm sorry. But azote carbonamide was the same kind of chemical that was put into yoga mats in order to give it the texture it has. And reading that several years after I'd eaten Subway so excessively within college, there was something in my soul that just shriveled and shrunk and died. Like, I didn't feel like a human being. Why? Because bread shouldn't have any kind of common chemicals with yoga mats, right? And I was disgusted and I was repulsed and I didn't feel very human because I don't want to eat yoga mats. I want to eat flour, which is eventually turned into bread, right? How different is it when we eat yoga mat bread than when we go to a real restaurant, a restaurant like Caprice, which is my favorite restaurant in Redlands? At Caprice, my wife recently got a roasted beet salad. And the roasted beet salad at Caprice is made up of arugula, roasted beets, Humboldt Fog Chervet, which is some sort of cheese, avocado, pistachios, and then you can add trout or chicken. But because I'm vegetarian, I just went with those five ingredients. And my wife got it. She said, "Do you want some?" I said, "Yes." I took a bite and it was bitter because I'd only gotten the arugula. And because I'm a noob, I didn't understand that that was bitter because I'm just an idiot. And my wife said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, I think it's awful." And she said, "Well, you got to get every ingredient together because the way these people make food, they try to get all of the flavors to play off one another." And I was able to get all five ingredients, arugula, roasted beet, Humboldt, Fog, Chervet, avocado, and pistachio together in one bite. And it was amazing. And I tell you this because there's a big difference between real food and chemicals. There's a real difference between taste and hunger. There's a real difference between being human and trying to take shortcuts around how we are human. And you could dismiss this as trivial and say, like, really, what does it matter what we eat? But what the author of Hebrews is suggesting to that is to be human is to be good. And so the more that we eat real food rather than artificial chemicals, the more good the life is that we live. Which brings us to what we drink. Now, in 2014, the Washington Post posted a very interesting article and study that I found very informative about the way that Americans drink alcohol. Now, the study was published in an article entitled "Think You Drink a Lot? This Chart Will Tell You." And it was trying to show you if you drink X amount of drinks per week, where you fall in relation to other Americans. So they broke up all the Americans into 10th percentiles, and they tried to show how many Americans drink how many drinks a week. So to give you an idea of what this is like, the 0th percentile drink 0 drinks per week. In fact, it's the 0th to 30th percentile that drinks any drinks because 30% of American adults don't drink alcohol at all. Then in the 30th percentile, those Americans drink 0.02 drinks per week. So in other words, they have about a drink a month. The 40th percentile, American adults drink 0.14 drinks per week, so once every 10 days. The 50th percentile of Americans drink about half a drink each week, so every other week. And then the 60th percentile of Americans drink about 2 drinks a week. And then things begin to change in the 70th percentile. The 70th percentile of Americans drink about 6 drinks a week. So if somebody were to have a glass of wine with their meal every night, they fall in the 70th percentile of American adults drinking. The 80th percentile more than doubles that number. The 80th percentile of Americans drinks 15 drinks a week, more than 2 drinks a day. Which brings us to the 90th percentile. And when I first read this number, I didn't believe it. The 90th percentile of American adults who drink 74 drinks per week. That's more than 10 per day. This isn't human. I don't know if you've ever had a family member or a friend who's fallen victim to alcoholism. But what I've seen from the people that I love who are alcoholics is that they barely are human. They are a shell of themselves. And it is heartbreaking to watch. And there are 24 million Americans who average about 74 drinks a week. And if you're listening to this podcast and you need help with your addictions, we want to help you as a church community. If you have a friend or a family member who's going through this and you need help personally for the grief that you deal with, we want to be a church that can help you grieve this tragedy as well. But the fact is that alcoholism is a real disease. And you can conquer it. You can change the way that you are. But it begins with a recognition that I want to be human again. Because the way that we drink can deny our humanity. Contrast that with the tattoo artist Kat Von D. On July 8, 2017, she posted a picture of herself on social media. And on this picture, she posted a one-sentence caption. And the caption was this: "Today I celebrate 10 years of sobriety." And I found this very moving because I don't know Kat Von D's story. I have followed her work from afar. I think that she's a very talented artist. But anytime somebody commits to being sober and celebrates an anniversary of sobriety, my heart swells because it's the triumph of the human spirit. In an interview with Rosie O'Donnell, she responded to this about 3 years ago as to why she felt like she had to cut alcohol out of her life. She said these words: "I'm a pretty disciplined person, but I had made a promise to myself that if there was ever anything getting in the way of my ability to tattoo, that I would cut it out." And so Kat Von D found that her humanity lied in her artwork and alcohol was interfering with her humanity. So she got rid of it. This is what the author of Hebrews is talking about. To be human is to be good. And if there are things that are in your life that prevent you from being human, you should cut them out. You should get rid of them because the best thing you can be is what God created you to be. Which brings us to sex. Now, I don't know if you've followed the news the past couple of weeks, but it has been a devastating news cycle. There has been so much pain and so much heartache that has come forward because so many women and men who have been survivors of sexual assault have said words like "me too" and "this happened to me." And they've named names and they've pointed the finger at people who have long avoided justice. And there has been a tremendous outpouring of courage from people who are willing to stand up and say, "I don't care how famous you are, how powerful you are, you cannot act this inappropriately to me. You cannot attack me and get away with it." One story that I found particularly moving was the story of a woman named Portia de Rossi, who's an actress in Arrested Development, as well as Ally McBeal. And she told a story about how she was auditioning for a part on a Steven Seagal movie. And she auditioned for the part. She made it to the final three, I believe. And as she got to the final three, Steven Seagal called her into his office. And he began to talk to her about the importance of chemistry. First, the importance of chemistry on screen. And then he said, "And when we have chemistry on screen, that stems from chemistry off screen." And at that point, according to Portia de Rossi, Steven Seagal unzipped his pants and propositioned her for sex. She ran out of the office screaming, refusing to participate in that. And she did not get the part in the Steven Seagal movie. This isn't human. That's not a human sexual relationship. That's power. That's abuse. That's assault, but it's not a human sexual relationship. And for too long, powerful men have used their power to reduce women or other men to something less than a human being. And this has to stop, and we men have to get better at calling it out and exposing this and believing people who say this has happened to me too, because for too long, we've protected powerful men who have raped and assaulted and behaved in ways that are just lewd and horrible to people who have less power than they do. Compare and contrast the evil, despicable act of Steven Seagal with Portia de Rossi's current relationship, her healthy human relationship with her spouse. Just this past summer, Portia de Rossi celebrated her 9th wedding anniversary with her spouse, Ellen DeGeneres. And she posted a blurry picture that was grainy from one of their first dates. And on it, she posted this picture and she said this caption. She said, "We've been together so long that not only do we look like kids in this picture, but it was taken with a real camera." And on the same day, Ellen DeGeneres posted a picture of her and Portia de Rossi on her wedding day. She tagged Portia de Rossi and she said, "Portia and I got married 9 years ago today. Being her wife is the greatest thing I am." This is human. Whenever there is fidelity and commitment and a celebration of anniversaries, this is what a healthy human sexual relationship looks like. This is human. And whenever we see fidelity and commitment, we should celebrate the humanity of relationships around us. Another story about sex. I just went to a funeral last weekend of a woman who lived to be 99 years. And her husband started dating back in the 1930s, which was a few years ago. And as you can imagine, dating in the 1930s is a lot different than dating in 2017. So much so they don't even call it dating back then. They called it courting. And the way this worked is this woman was in college in the Philippines. This 99-year-old woman whose funeral I attended was in college in the Philippines, and she received a note from a man who asked if he could court her. And attached to the note was an orchid. And also in the note was instructions. And the instructions said, "If you want me to court you, then please place the orchid on your left lapel. If you don't want me to court you, place the orchid on your right lapel." And as I was listening to this woman's eulogy this past weekend, I began tearing up as I heard about this man waiting at this church service for this woman to arrive, anxiously waiting to see where this orchid would be. And he said that she showed up late, but when she showed up, she was wearing the orchid, and it was on her left lapel. They began to court one another. They got engaged. They got married. And 10 months after they got married, they had their first daughter, and her name was Orchid. Oh, man, as I tell you that story, as I'm recording this podcast, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up. Why? Because it's a human story. It's what relationships and romance and intimacy should be, right? And if we really believe that to be human is to be good, then we hear a story like this and we know it to be true. That's what a relationship should be. One last story about sex or romance or relationships. They're all kind of the same thing, aren't they? I was a student at La Sierra University, and this white guy who was in my class was wearing a barong. Now, a barong is a Filipino shirt, and I know what a barong is because I'm married to a Filipino woman. But this white guy showed up to class wearing a barong, and I thought to myself, who is this guy? Like, seriously, what's his deal? Why does he think he needs to be Filipino? He's clearly not. Quit trying to be something you aren't. And a week went by because our class met weekly. And the next week, the guy showed up again. This white guy showed up again wearing a different barong. And I'm like, what, does this guy have a closet full of barongs? Like, what's his deal? And the week after that, he showed up with another barong and another barong. And every week that went by that he showed up with his barong, I was like, this guy is a loser. I judged him every week. And I thought, I can't stand this guy. What is he doing? And so after 8 weeks of this class, it's a 10-week class, I finally decide I'm going to go up and talk to him. So I go up and talk to this guy in a barong, and I say, "Hey, man, how are you?" He says, "I'm good." I said, "I noticed you're wearing a barong." He's like, "Yeah." I said, "Can I ask you why?" And he said, "Sure, I'd be happy to tell you." And he told me a story about how he went to the Philippines, and he met his wife there, and they started dating, and they fell in love. And they fell in love so much that they decided they were going to get married to each other. But there was a major problem because he wanted to live in America and she wanted to live in the Philippines. And they went back and forth, trying to figure out what they should do. And eventually they came to a decision that they both supported. And the decision was this. She would return with him to America as long as he promised to live like a Filipino in America. And so his whole family would live as if they were Filipinos, and they would live with Filipino culture and food in the middle of America. And so he looks at me and he says, I wear a barong to keep my promise to my wife. And at this point, I thought to myself, well, I am a terrible person. Because that is a beautiful story, right? I mean, here was a guy keeping a promise to his wife, and I'm over there judging him, saying like, oh, cultural appropriation, all this stuff, right? But his wife made him promise that he would do this, and so he's happy to do it. Why? Because he loves his wife. These three stories are incredibly moving to me. Why? Because they're about human relationships, and there's one way to have sex where it's just a dehumanizing, objective thing. And there is another way to have sex where you enter into a long-standing, committed relationship and it moves the soul and it moves the heart. Why? Because it's a human relationship. And the story of Hebrews and the story of Jesus is simply this: to be human is to be good. May we learn, my brothers and sisters, to be human. Why? Because to be human is to be good. May you see and embrace the inspiration in all.